nice Christmas picture. I can't wait to hear the next one.
Okay, if you'll take your seats, please.
All right, Marvin. Excellent. I'm reading his letter right now.
Marvin's letter? Where is it? Oh, it's up here. Just tell me what it says. Paraphrase it for me. Dr. Valentine, at your convenience. Why are you laughing?
Russell goes, yeah.
Good evening. Welcome to the regularly scheduled January 13th meeting of the San Luis Coastal Unified School District Board of Trustees. The board previously met in closed session, and we discussed several items. A real property item regarding Avila School property, and direction was given to staff. A real property item regarding the old Pacheco School property, and discussion and direction was given to staff. And then general discussion regarding labor negotiations. So, do we have consensus on the order of business? Okay. Approval of the minutes.
I move to approve the minutes for December 9th, 2008.
Sorry, I have something I'd like to change.
Dr. Eisner,
I'm sorry. I think we have to have a motion on the floor before we can have discussion.
John made a motion.
Right, it needs a second.
It needs a second. Okay, I'll second.
I'll be happy to make a second.
Okay, Mr. Buckman? A second. Dr. Eisendrath Rogers.
I'd like to propose two changes. One has to do with the correspondence section, and that is that I would like to add there that Ivan Simon, the chairman of the English department at San Luis High School, provided us with a letter which was read in part into the record. And secondly, on item 11, response to board questions regarding benchmark process, I'd like to propose the following language. It's a little lengthy, so bear with me.
To replace
what we have here. And that would read, the board received a report on the ongoing benchmark assessment project. Dr. Matakovich indicated that we needed more engagement at the front end of this process to build teacher ownership. She indicated that the multiple choice format has been problematic to some teachers, particularly in language arts. She indicated that teachers have expressed a desire for more authentic assessment. It was also noted that teachers have had an opportunity to pick the standards, to decide when the standards will be taught, to design the test, to modify the test, and to discuss the performance of students with colleagues. The option for authentic assessment has been provided to each site with the promise of district support for the development. Catherine, me, I wanted staff to continue conversations with San Luis High School regarding authentic assessment. The board was able to ask questions of the two high school principals, targeting the concepts of flexibility, collaboration, and focus on the achievement gap. No teachers were present.
Okay, is there any objection to that change?
I cannot support the change.
Entertain the changes before we dispose
of
the
opinion.
I think Catherine can
amend.
Ask for an amendment to the motion, and that would take a second, and then we would vote on the amendment to the motion,
right.
And then it would go back to the main motion,
right.
I believe.
You got an amendment first.
So there has to be a second to Catherine's reading.
I'll second Catherine's reading.
So there's the amended motion.
So, okay.
And I want to check this out.
So we need to vote on the amended
discussion first.
Okay.
The only, most of that sounds good. I just can't recall. That's my problem. I can't recall. And I would just suggest that if there is something that's going to be replacing what's there, it would be good to maybe see it earlier, if possible. And I'm not criticizing that, but it would help just to be able to see it and, you know, remember what went on, because I don't recall everything that night that way. That's my only concern.
Mr. Miller.
Sorry, I'm used to those real fancy ones. Catherine, if you could just, within your amendment, if you could just highlight the pieces that you feel are specifically different, because I know you tried to cover both. It sounded like you were trying to cover both what was there and what you're thinking.
How the proposed changes are different from what we see in front of us, okay? Sure. I guess an overall note would be that the implication from what's here is more of a kind of consensus. I think what I read indicates an ownership that of the recommendations that Dr. Matakovich actually made, that there is some work that needs to be done and will be done, and as opposed to something that exists as a whole that is going to remain unchanged.
Mr. Miller.
Well, I have read the suggested changes by Catherine, and I do think they add about three things, but I don't think they change substantively the synopsis by Mrs. Holmes. I did have the opportunity to view the discussion just the other day on replay, and I think that Catherine's amendment captures the discussion and adds in some points which at least to some of the board members were important to add, and I, as much as I appreciate our clerk's hard work, I don't know that there's anything sacred in the sense that we can't substitute other language as long as it represents materially what happened at the board meeting.
Mr. Spadafore.
The sentence of your summation about the ongoing work to be done, I mean, I can support that, the way you phrased it, to add or to amend what is here, because I think that does capture the direction that the board discussed in terms of the future relative to assessment benchmark testing. Mm-hmm. So I will withdraw my motion. But we would see probably the best way to do, instead of voting on the amended motion, I would withdraw my motion so an amended motion can be made. Another motion can be made based upon the sentence that you offered. I withdraw my motion.
The first motion.
I didn't.
Okay, I'll. I'm not sure how comfortable I am with withdrawing it and just adding the one sentence. But I think we should just have a vote on that amended motion.
Okay, so we're voting on the amended motion, which substitutes the verbiage that we heard tonight for the minutes, item 11, as recorded by Mrs. Holmes.
Yes.
Correct?
Yes.
Okay. Those in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
So we've got four in favor and three opposed. And those opposed were Mr. Buckman, Mr. Spadafore, and Mr. Unger. So that carries. Moving on, we have a presentation from Morro Bay High School.
I'm a little bit uncomfortable with where we left, because the motion was specific to amending that entry in the minutes, and yet it remains left to be approved, the rest of the minutes.
Morro Bay High School is excited this year that we are going to ask your permission to present the every 15-minute documentation or documentary here at our school here at the end of the school year. To do that, I am going to introduce to you Casey Chaffee, who managed this program when she graduated from Morro Bay High School in 2005. And Casey will present this tonight for us. So, Casey Chaffee.
Hi, you guys are lucky you're not going to hear me talk too much tonight. But my name is Casey Chaffee, and first of all, I'd like to thank you guys for having us here tonight. And the last time I was here, I was actually a senior at Morro Bay High School, and I did help to run this program. I'm currently a senior at Cal Poly right now, and I'm a student intern at Friday Night Live. We're a nonprofit drug and alcohol prevention program for youth, and we're run out of the county drug and alcohol services. And we are happy that every year in the county, we have the opportunity, we get grants, and we have the opportunity at two different high schools to run this program. And Morro Bay High School is scheduled for it for this year at the end of May. So I'd like to introduce to you two great students who will explain to you a little bit more about the program, Claire Hoos and Mandy Irons.
I'm Amanda Irons. I'm a sophomore at Morro Bay High School, and I'm an active member in Friday Night Live Club.
I'm Claire Hoos. I'm a senior at Morro Bay High School, and I'm an active member in the Friday Night Live Club also.
First, we'd like to start off with some county-specific statistics from fall 2007 California Healthy Kids Survey. By ninth grade, 46% of San Luis Obispo County students had used alcohol at least once. 4% of students had used alcohol on school property within 30 days from when the survey was taken. 72% of 7th graders strongly disapprove of underage alcohol use, but by 9th grade, only 51% strongly disapprove. We also have some disappointing drinking and driving stats from our San Luis Obispo County students. 50% of 7th graders had been in a car with a driver who had been drinking. 11% of those had done it 7 or more times. 21% of 9th graders had been in a car with a driver who had been drinking. 28% of 11th graders had been in a car with a driver who had been drinking, with 10% of those reporting to have done it 3 to 6 times. As you can see, these statistics range to all age groups, thus stressing the importance of this program.
Most people already know the statistic that alcohol is the number one drug of choice for teens in our society, and with this in mind, we feel that it is necessary to take action. This year, Morro Bay High School implemented the two-day drinking and driving awareness program every 15 minutes on May 21st and 22nd. Every 15 minutes consists of a mock DUI crash the first day and a mock funeral the second day. It is a true partnership between Friday Night Live, the school administration and staff, and various community agencies such as the police and fire departments. Although the program is facilitated by adults, it is something that is truly implemented by young people for young people. There will be 40 or so students that will be directly involved with the program, along with the entire student body who will observe it. Our hope is that every 15 minutes will help to shed light on the problems caused by alcohol use among youth and the dangers of drinking and driving. The program is generously funded with a grant provided by the California Highway Patrol and the California Office of Traffic Safety. As you may remember, this program was last implemented at Morro Bay High in 2005 and had a very positive impact on both the school and community. At this time, we are asking for support from the San Luis Coastal Unified School Board for every 15 minutes program to be held May 21st and 22nd, 2009 at Morro Bay High School. We would also like to extend an invitation to all board members to come and see the event on either or both days. In the information we have gave you, the program is actually more thoroughly explained. And to make this program as effective as possible, only the 40 students directly involved and their parents, along with school staff, will be aware that this program is taking place. So we hope that you would help us in keeping this as quiet as possible.
Thank you.
May 21st?
Yeah, 21st, 22nd.
Oh, 21st, 22nd.
Okay. Comments?
That's a fantastic program, and thank you for putting that before everyone, both at Morro Bay High School and in the district. And I wanted to just add to that, when I read about what you are doing, it reminded me that a parent I know of a child who's just getting his permit signed him up with the California Highway Patrol. They every month they do.
Marvin Petch, campus supervisor at San Luis Obispo High School. And we also received correspondence from Dr. Julian Crocker, the County Office of Education. In which he approves the tentative agreement that we've entered into with the SEIU, one of our bargaining units. Any other correspondence? Okay. Then.
Madam President?
Yes.
We may want to acknowledge that we had received a couple of correspondences from Avila community members regarding the Avila Schoolhouse property.
Thank you very much. Public comment. Okay, no request. Does anyone present wish to speak in public comment? Okay, then we'll move on. We have reports by student representatives, school staff, administrators, and board members. Okay, Matt Irons, would you like to go first from Morro Bay High School?
Yeah, sure. At Morro Bay High School, our semester's ending here next week, and because of this, we're having our finals the 20th through the 22nd, so that's next Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. And also next week, we have our CIT wrestling tournament, and that's on the 23rd and 24th. And it's a national wrestling tournament. We have over 60 schools attending. And I'd like to invite all the board, and if you would like seats to that, contact either me or Mr. Zodovich, and we'll get you seats. It's the 23rd and 24th, so next Friday and Saturday. And also we have auditions for our school musical, Lucky Stiff, and the show will be held in the end of March. And finally, our distinguished school application was successfully reviewed by the state committee, and they've set up a visit on February the 2nd. And that day was chosen because one of our signature practices was our collaborative work on Late Start Mondays, and February 2nd is a Late Start Monday. And so that's the reason for that date, February 2nd. And that's what's going on in Morro Bay in the next month.
Thank you. Katie O'Neill.
At San Luis Obispo High School, our winter sports have started. So with that, we had a winter sports rally last Friday, and we gave out academic awards as well as recognized our winter sports. And to receive one of these academic awards, you have to have a 3.8 or higher GPA for three consecutive trimesters. And we had quite a bit of them, so it was nice. And then tomorrow is our college planning parent for 11th grade parents, and it informs 11th grade junior parents about college applications and the process of getting into college and different options and things such as that. And this week, sophomores are participating in their career planning activities with their counselors throughout the school day. And also this week, on the 27th of January for sophomores, it'll begin the parent-student counselor meetings for sophomores, and they meet with their counselors for career guidance, and I personally went through the process last year, and it's really helpful because you talk about what your current, like, career kind of goals are, and then you kind of base your junior classes around it, which is a really important year, so they give you advice about that, and they tell you what you need to start doing concerning, like, SATs and ACTs and things such as that for the beginning of the year. And the 21st and 22nd is our junior college orientation meeting for seniors, mostly about Cuesta. And these occur throughout the school days. Counselors will have meetings with classes. And February 2nd is the grad night meeting for all the parents who wish to help out with this senior event. It's an end-of-the-year kind of senior celebration that we have, so lots of parents help out. And the meeting's going to be at 7 o'clock in the library. And on the 15th is the Principal's Advisory Council meeting in the library at 7, and all parents are welcome to come. And teachers have recently received the new TEACH grant applications. And they're due at the end of January, and they're really excited about that, as always. And our winter formal is coming up. It's on the 23rd of January, and it's going to be at the end of the year. Our name this year is The Snowball, and the theme is kind of a play on a winter wonderland. So we're going to have, like, snowflakes on the ceiling and, you know, like, blue sheer tablecloths and stuff. So it's going to be really neat. ASB's been working really hard on that. And the first week in February, we're going to have a multicultural week. We've had it in the past, but not for a while. And basically what happens is throughout the week, we'll have, like, different events displaying different cultures. And these are done through representatives, like students in the school and clubs that are based on cultural differences. And so they kind of, we're going to have...
SBA conference, and that was up in Sacramento. And I have enjoyed watching the legislators. I'm trying to find a teachable moment in what they're doing, and I think that they're acting as a fine example to our students for their lack of ability to work together and the outcome of what laziness comes to. And I'm sending each of our two representatives a copy of everything I needed to learn I learned in kindergarten.
Thank you, Mr. Buckman. Mr. Unger.
Well, I was lucky enough to be able to attend both the Morro Bay High Band concert and the San Luis Obispo Choir concert, along with other board members. And then along with Mr. Angel, this Saturday I got to be on a panel for new board members with the San Luis Obispo County School Boards Association. And I got to discuss life on the school board. Phil was there as a... he was involved in a lot of the workshop itself. And then also, I'd just like to thank Del Mar Elementary School for putting on the Las Posadas. It was a really wonderful occasion, and there were hundreds of families here at Del Mar. Food everywhere, food for as far as you could see, and then great entertainment. We're going to have the CSBA Board of Directors next weekend. It should be really interesting, given that the governor is doing his January budget speech, I think, or the State of the State on the 15th, so it's going to be really interesting. And then just a reminder to everybody on the board that this coming Thursday from 2 to 4 is the CSBA budget webcast. And if you can't see it live, I would suggest that you go back to the website and look at it after the fact. It's really interesting and very insightful, so I would suggest you all check that one out too.
Thank you, Mr. Unger. Mr. Spadafore.
Thank you. This coming Monday at 12:30, Catherine, Mark, and I will be meeting at my office to develop structure for the study session as was directed by the board.
Thank you. Anyone else? Okay, then we'll move on to status of the state budget. Oh, Dr. Valentine.
Yeah, I thought we are moving on to status of the state budget. I wanted to share with the board that I had the opportunity yesterday to be in Sacramento for the School Services of California overview of the governor's proposed budget. And I thought I'd share just a few of those highlights, and Russell can jump in and provide the technical expertise that you may wish. In spite of the rhetoric with the passage of Proposition 13 in the 1970s, education spending in California dropped from the top five states to the bottom 10 in the nation. The state has borrowed virtually all the money it can to stave off past crises, deferring payment to future generations, and requiring true cuts and or revenue enhancements to address the current situation. Money which was counted upon to pay current expenses and debts is not only not materializing, but is vanishing at astonishing rates. As recently as September, UCLA predicted that the state and nation would avoid a recession. In the intervening 3 months, the deficit in California has doubled to an astounding $40 billion out of an approximately $100 billion budget. one of the comments at the conference in showing what was predicted to be the state deficit in September and what was really the state deficit by December, the question was asked, do you really have to be an economist to be this wrong? The governor proposes revenue limit cuts to education, including both cuts and unfunded COLAs to the tune of a 16% deficit, meaning that for every dollar owed education in California, the 46th lowest funded state in the nation, schools will receive only 84 cents of that dollar. In order to deal with the consequences of the budget proposal, the governor has recommended that restrictions on the use of most state categorical dollars be lifted and the dollars be usable for any general education purpose. These include dollars for class size reduction. The governor proposes lifting the 180-day minimum school year requirement and allowing schools to reduce the school year by 5 days to 175. To do so would require a negotiated agreement with affected employees. Future. For us, the majority of the catastrophic budget hits in the governor's proposal are to the revenue limit. These affect us less than hits to categoricals. We do receive state categorical funding. We don't receive revenue limit funding. This affects us less than shared pain formulas, which don't exist in the proposal. It's important, however, in preparing ourselves to note that the governor's proposal in January is just that, a proposal. We are well aware that the governor came out with a proposal last January. An actual budget wasn't adopted until September. That adopted budget was rendered unrecognizable and completely fictional before the ink dried. The legislature is completely dysfunctional to deal with the crisis. Regardless of the governor's proposed budget from last January, regardless of the adopted budget 3 months ago, we still don't know what 2008 and 2009 will ultimately look like, let alone 09-10. And so to rely on the governor's proposal for clarity and direction is problematic at best. The rationales for long-term decisions based upon the proposal may not hold up through the week. And so our challenge is to develop a budget strategy in the midst of chaos. Even if we are less impacted in the proposal, what will the real impact in a real budget ultimately be? What is the role of reserves when we see the landscape eroding around us everywhere we look? What are our assumptions about how long the recession will last? What finance reforms it will generate? And what is the prudent disposition of resources at this time while still being fair with employees and committed to our educational mission? This is what we will be considering and bringing forward this spring. I open it up to Russell if he'd like to add to that.
I don't think there's too much to add to what Ed's talking about. I think one of the biggest issues to grapple with at the state level is the reduction in revenues that they've seen. The ridiculous nature of the pledge that the Republicans have signed can be highlighted by the idea that within the characteristics of revenue available to the state, one of the primary ones is personal income tax. And personal income tax right now, because 1% of the taxpayers pay 50% of all income taxes, i.e. the highest payers, they are going to have a shortfall of projected income tax of $8.9 billion. So that we have the Republicans on one hand pledging not to raise taxes, when the reality is taxes are going to come in far under anybody's previous estimate. If you take a look at the shortfall in income taxes, it can be attributed to the capital gains tax. Capital gains tax in the past was $57 billion in 2007. In 2008, it's going to drop by $6.3 billion alone because of the free fall of the markets and the financial systems. So you have three primary revenue sources for the state: sales taxes, income taxes, and property taxes. All of them are in basic free fall right now, and taxes are going down whether the Republicans or the Democrats like it or not. What they choose to do about that will frame what the future of California's economic security is going to be like. What we have to do as a school district is try to adjudicate all of those issues and put together the very best plan we can, as Ed says, in the midst of chaos, because nobody's taking the reins of control at the state level. In the midst of this chaos, how are we going to craft our budget? And over the next 3 or 4 months, you guys are going to get a lot of stuff in terms of information and recommendations and outcome about how that budget is going to be recommended to you for adoption. But clearly, until somebody at the state, and I don't think you could leave anybody out, but until somebody wakes up, does the job that they're getting paid for, and brings some order to the chaos, we're going to be in deep trouble, and the uncertainty of it all is going to cause a lot of districts to make a lot of mistakes as they move forward because they're making assumptions that won't come true.
Mr. Unger.
Yeah, just a couple of questions. We talk about school being shorter by potentially 5 days. Aren't we really looking at between 8 and 11 days, since there are 3 to 6 days of staff development? And wouldn't we expect...
Your question was?
Are we going to be affected
warrants,
by...
Warrants, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Good. We're not going to be impacted to the significant degree that others, because obviously we don't get a whole lot of state money. I think that there are some categorical programs that are significant in size, class size reduction, K-3 for one, that... They're already, one of the major proposals is to defer payment of that appropriation until next year, July 2009. What that does is it pushes down the spending of Prop 98, the floor of Prop 98. Historically, the way the formula is written is that that floor in 08-09 becomes the floor in 09-10 plus COLA plus growth. Well, if they can push that floor even lower by not spending money in 08-09, they save a significant amount of money that transfers to 09-10. It's a numbers game. It's smoke and mirrors, but it works in terms of the Prop 98 formula. So I seriously think that we will see a shortfall in our funding, but for our particular situation, cash flow is not at this moment jeopardized because of what's being talked about at this moment.
Anyone else? Thank you. Moving on, we have a public hearing. The proposed reopener agreement with Service Employees International Union. Mr. Robinette.
Thank you. Unless you want to just bang the gavel and hold the hearing, but I can just make a couple of comments. As required by law, we need to have a public hearing anytime we either... open up sunshine negotiations or actually come to an agreement, and I'm very pleased to announce that the board and Service Employees International Union Local 620 came to a reopener agreement for the 2008-09 school year, which appears later in the as an action consent agenda for a one-year contract. And so at this time we need to have a public hearing in case any members of the public wish to speak on that agreement.
Thank you. I'll open the public hearing. Is there anyone who would like to come forward? Seeing no one, then the public hearing is closed. We move on. We have a resolution. Resolution number 070809, approval of behavioral intervention plans, the Hughes bill, mandated cost claim settlement, and agreement to waive future claims. Jackie Kirk Martinez.
Good evening. Thank you. I would like to take this opportunity and explain a little bit more than what is in your packet this evening. I We have in your packet the agenda item as well as the resolution and the LEA information, local education agency information, and the waiver. In response to legislation known as the Hughes Bill, and the State Board of Education in 1993 adopted regulations requiring districts and county offices to develop behavior intervention plans for special education students who exhibit behaviors that require a systematic plan to be developed. The regulation detailed more requirements than what IDEA, Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, required. It imposed lots of costly requirements which exceeded federal law, and this claim has been tied up in mandated reimbursement process for over 14 years. It is thank you to the efforts of the California School Board Association, the Education Legal Alliance, that I'm able to be able to speak before you today. It's their efforts that on behalf of San Diego Unified School District, Butte, San Joaquin County Office of Education, there's been a settlement. And it's been through this behavior intervention mandate with the state that this settlement and discussion has been tied up in the courts. As a result, though, because of these three districts and the School Board Education Legal Alliance, all districts, county offices, and CELFAs will be able to receive additional monies starting 2009-2010. Starting that time, all of the districts, county office of education, and the CELFAs will see an increase in the special education funding in the amount of over $65 million. And then starting in 2010 and 11 for an additional 6 years, there'll be also cost of living adjustments. We will see districts receiving over $510 million. It'll be over a six-year increment. And so again, our district would like to personally thank the School Board Association, the Education Legal Alliance, that really helped in making this settlement possible. I'm open for any questions that you might have.
Okay. Mr. Millar? Oh, Mr. Unger.
I'm just curious, so this might be a question for Russell. On page 410, it talks about 3B, it talks about that the payments may be suspended in a year in which test 3 of Prop 98 is operative. Are we in test 3 year, and will we see that money, do you think, this year? How do you think that's going to shake out?
You're going to test me. I think that the Test 3 Prop 98 funding model has only been implemented once since Prop 98 was passed. So the likelihood of going into a Test 3 is very slim. We are not in Test 3 now, and I don't know what would, out of all of the stuff that's going on, I don't know what, if anything, would push us into Test 3.
Mr. Moore.
So, as I understand it, Jackie, after if we sign on and 92% of the district's COEs and CELPAs agree to this settlement, then the only increases that we will see in these funds in subsequent years is COLA and ADA increases, correct?
After the 6 years, correct.
After
and that's 85%, okay. Yes.
But after that 6 years, the funding will continue on, but that's the only way we'll receive increases.
It will have an additional increase in the base of the special education funding.
Just to be
there's
clear.
There's an increase there,
yeah,
from the base.
Exactly. Just to be clear, there's two segments to the settlement. One is all of the past claims that they didn't honor, they now have to pay us. And that amounts to the $510 million. That's the $101,000 per year. And that's going to come over 6 years. There's a $75,000 per year approximate increase on our AB-602 funding. So the AB-602 is now being paid at a little bit in excess, I think, of $1,000 per ADA. This drives that up by, I'm not sure, but somewhere probably in the neighborhood of $13 or $15 per ADA. That money will be subject to COLA and growth in the future years.
And we are waiving our right to make, this is a subtle distinction, I was trying to figure it out, we're waiving our right to make future unknown claims, but still maintaining, we still have a right to maintain, to make claims that we currently know about?
On this bill, go ahead, Jackie, I'm sorry. Yeah, it settles it. There is no, there will be no.
So no distinct. Okay, so we're waiving the right to any future claims under the unmandated, the mandated cost provisions
for behavior intervention plans.
Right, for this specific thing. Okay, and the only other comment I'll make is that after 14 years of litigation, I'm a little worried about all these unemployed lawyers. So,
so do we, Walter.
Mr. Buckman.
Walter eloquently discussed some of the points I wanted to ask, and I thank you. The only remaining one is, as the whole process of mandated cost recovery gets more and more complicated with the state, and I don't know, what are we, in year three now of not being paid? Yeah. Does this now become somehow a precedent or a model for settling mandated claims? And I don't, I mean, have you heard any talk?
Well, I think that the state has forced us into litigation in a number of different claims, and this isn't the only one. There was another one that was out there about inter-district transfers that's going through the courts. It's been, at each stage so far, it's been found in favor of districts, but there have been numerous other examples in the past about mandated cost claims. Now, one of the significant decisions that was made, or not decisions, but one of the significant proposals in the governor's budget is to suspend mandates. And it's pretty clear that that's an illegal action based upon the idea that mandates are embedded in the Constitution. And for the governor to simply suspend them and the subsequent payments necessary to pay for them is not within the purview of his powers. So I think we're going to see some additional issues about mandated cost claims in the near future as this budget rolls forward, too.
I just want to make a comment about Mark's question. It was excellent. The fundamental test cases determine that the state's position that the name of the bill, the state bill, did not require things beyond the IDEA.
There was per mandate, and there's 32 mandates on the books, or $32,000 total dollars to all districts in the state, they've met their obligation. That was just found to be insufficient and not correct. So now the state has to come out and refund, but find funding to pay for all of these 3 years' worth of mandates. And that was what prompted the governor to say, okay, I'm suspending all mandates now because we're not going to pay for them. Or I'm suspending them and now I don't have to pay for them. So whichever way you look at it, it's become a political issue about not paying.
Mr. Spadafore.
Thank you, Marilyn. The decision we have to make tonight is to become part of, if I understand this, the class districts or the LEAs that are going to agree to this settlement. If they don't reach the percentage necessary, then the settlement's not going to go through. They have to have a certain percentage of all the districts and a certain percentage of the local plans to make this a complete deal.
Correct.
So all we're doing tonight is saying we agree with the settlement proposal. If, in fact, they don't reach the number necessary, then it won't go through anyway. Is that correct?
That's my understanding, yes.
Okay. So basically, our choice is either to say, yes, we agree to add to the percentage so the settlement goes through, or we step aside, and if the settlement goes through anyway because there's the necessary percentage, it'll occur, no matter what we do tonight.
Madam President.
Mr. Unger.
I'd like to make a motion to approve resolution number 070809.
I'll second that.
Okay. I just had one question. Jackie, provided any monies really are realized from this, they would be categorically applied?
No, it would go into the general fund.
Okay, thank you. Does this need to be treated as two separate We have the resolution, and then we have the waiver. Do those have to be approved separately?
The resolution, if I may, the resolution authorizes Dr. Valentine to sign the waiver.
So just one is required.
It's just one is required.
So then we have a motion by Mr. Unger and a second by Mr. Buckman. Mrs. Holmes?
Mr. Unger?
Yes.
Mr. Buckman?
Yes.
Dr. Eisendrath-Rogers? Mr. Millar?
Aye.
Mrs. Roger?
Yes.
Mr. Spadafore? Mr. Angel? Passes 7-0.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Item 5, approval of revised board policy 6146.1, graduation credits for class of 2013 and beyond at San Luis Obispo High School. Okay, Mr. Jones.
Good evening. Will Jones, principal of San Luis Obispo High School. And we return tonight for tonight's board meeting to continue the discussion and ask for action on the item number 5 regarding the increase in the graduation credits for the class of 2013 and beyond. There isn't any change in the request that we're making from the previous meeting, but I'd be happy to entertain any questions that you might have since then.
Mr. Unger.
Just a students will continue to be able to take Cuesta classes for credit and have that apply toward their graduation credits?
Yes.
Correct? Okay, thank you.
Dr. Eisendrath-Rogers.
Thank you. Well, I asked you this question before when you made this presentation, but I'd like some clarification if you don't mind. We're starting this with the class of 2013, and before you had said the reason for that is to give students notice when they come as a freshman that this is what is expected of them. And yet, from what I've read here, it doesn't seem as though they have an opportunity until their junior year to actually make a change in their schedule that would impact their graduation. And the reason I ask for clarification about this is I understand that the positive impact of this decision would be to help the enrollment in the music programs at the school, some of the elective classes, and I think that's a very important positive effect. So I'm wondering if you could explain if there's any reason we wouldn't start that with students who are not yet juniors, so have not yet made decisions that would impact upon their graduation requirements.
Well, I think simply because they came in with the understanding that they would be graduating with 270 credits and that families lay out a four-year plan that includes all the credits that they anticipate that they'd have to graduate over that 4 years. So to make that change now would kind of disrupt the plans they've made, would add for, let's say, juniors who have already kind of laid out their course of study for their junior and senior year, depending on what their plans are afterward, would then have to make an understanding that they would need 270 credits to graduate. And so I would, in our conversations about this, we were just uncomfortable with the idea of making a change after they'd already arrived at the school and kind of laid out their four-year plans with the expectation they came in with, which was the 270. So we just felt that it was cleaner to start with the new class rather than the other issue there would be also we would have to look at some kind of a, to be fair, we'd kind of have to look at a kind of a graduated credit requirement for graduation rather than to say to students that have already been there, let's say for 2 years, you're required to take 10 more credits and to send that same message to someone who's been there so it would be different for each class. So similar to when we went to the trimester, we had to do kind of graduated credit requirements based on where they were at the time we made the change. We'd have to do the same thing for the current students. So to keep it simple, we went with the incoming class and kind of stay with the agreement we had with the current students when they arrived at the school as freshmen.
I see. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Millar.
I move approval of revised board policy 6146.1.
I'll second that.
Okay, moved by Mr. Millar, seconded by Mr. Angel. But Mr. Buckman, a question?
Good time for discussion. I think I understand the motives behind this, and I think they're good to try and scoop up that last small percent of students that are below the 270s. I'm wondering about, if you know, just roughly maybe, what percent of the students are actually using this for makeup? Because I think originally there were a lot of originally the concept was students could use this to make up for insufficient credits.
I don't have a percentage of students who are taking advantage of that cushion strictly for makeup or remediation. I know that that happens in a variety of ways, but I don't have a percentage on that.
Okay. I'm sorry I didn't ask you sooner in the week. And then just as I look at the trends at the bottom of the page for 07 and 08, it's definitely going in favor. It looks like more and more students are taking advantage of the electives. And do you think that there's a possibility that that would happen naturally without having to change the graduation credits, that we'd get to the place you want to be?
Hard to predict with only 1 year of data that we provided here. We could go back and look at a trend over time. So I really can't answer that question authoritatively. I would kind of be guessing, and I think it changes from year to year. Every graduating class is a little bit different, so it would be hard to predict. But we just feel as if that two things will happen. One is that, of course, we'll automatically pick up that 15 or 16% of the students that are at the 270 to 275 range, and really feel as if it'll also bump up the number of students who take higher than 280 credits, just because no one wants to cut it, not very many students want to cut it that close. So we'd hope to see an increase in classes taken by students all the way from that 270 range up to, let's say, the 290 range.
Mr. Spadafore.
Thanks, Marilyn. Will this also, by beginning with the class of 2013, allow better planning for staffing as you see the curriculum grow to the added number? That's question number one.
Yes.
So that'll be more of a benefit in terms of planning future classes?
Correct. Well, we'll start to get a sense of the trend in terms of what classes the students are going to request, and that'll help with staffing for sure.
And the second question, do you think in any way that this will require the high school, San Luis High School, to be a little bit more cognizant of what the electives are and what's satisfying the needs of the students as they go along to choose those electives in terms of the classes and in terms of what's going to become available for those extra 10 credits plus what will be beneficial for graduation and beyond?
Yeah, I think one of the areas where we'll focus our efforts is on the elective classes we have that satisfy an A through G requirement for the UCs. So that's one area where we want to increase the number of electives in that area.
Mr. Buckman.
I just want to point out it's like something like 90%, I think, or maybe 83% of the students at San Luis High School now are going over the required units. What's being offered must be pretty appealing because it's competing with the beach and all the other things in our community. So,
well, it isn't that our elective programs are suffering, and the motivation behind this isn't necessarily to build up the numbers in our elective programs. The motivation is to have students take more classes. They have the opportunity to take excellent classes that already exist. And so this is an encouragement or a requirement.
Support for Personnel Commission action on classification review, the campus supervisor.
Thank you.
Mr. Robinette.
Thank you. This item, and actually the one following also, is an examples of that kind of careful dance we have to do between those things that are the purview of the Personnel Commission, which controls the job descriptions, classifications, range allocations of our classified employees, and the school board, who has the authority to allocate the dollars. And so we need to have both bodies take a look at both of these items. This first one has to do with the classification review that we've completed for our campus supervisor position. In 2004, we created a new position in the school district, as some of the board members may recall, and as Commissioner Spadafore at the time might have recalled, was to create a position of full-time campus supervisor for each of our high school campuses. It was felt that we needed to go beyond just the noon supervisor kind of lower level position to somebody who could actually have more of a security presence on our campus, get to know students, be proactive in security, in providing security to the campus. We do classification reviews as commissioned by the Personnel Commission on a 3 to 5 year basis, and we did a classification review of this position during this last year, and believe that the position has become one that has become more complex and has added responsibilities to it over the course of that time. And that's not surprising. It was a new position we created with a new job description. Much of it we modeled after a job description from Paso Robles School District. And so because of that, we believe that we need to be changing some of the responsibilities in the job description, as well as some of the requirements that we would expect somebody to have. We're very happy in the fact that we have two campus supervisors who have had that position since it was created and have remained in that position and have had the trainings that we are requiring. We also believe that it's important to allocate this position to a higher range on the CSEA schedule. And so we're recommending a range from 217 to 221, which is a 10% jump on the salary schedule. And so the purpose for the board is to say, okay, if the commission's okay with it, we can provide the money. And the estimated salary and benefit cost to implement these recommendations is about $7,000 for the two positions. And I'm available for any questions.
Total
for two positions.
Okay, we have a request to speak on this one, too. Mr. Petch.
Good evening, board members, Dr. Valentine, and the rest of San Luis Coastal Unified School District. I feel horrible after hearing Dr. Valentine give numbers. I'm here asking for it to be reviewed, and I feel so bad. But I feel that I have to do this. Both positions were reclassified. I understand that. My appeal is that both schools are different in needs. San Luis Coastal is a lot bigger. They have different programs there. They have the emotionally disturbed, the moderate to severe handicapped students. And a lot of the times, campus supervisor at San Luis Obispo is called up to that site to help assist, to de-escalate situations, whether it's student-student or student-teacher. It's a cluster site for the Yale students. Luckily, I'm bilingual, so it helps me out a lot. It helps a lot of the people and staff at San Luis as well. I guess my argument was that, and this, I felt really bad, but we're being offered a $1.80 raise, both campus supervisors, but I feel that the campus supervisor at San Luis Obispo High School, I mean, there's different needs for that person there. We have, like I said, a lot more things going on. Not saying that Morro Bay doesn't, but the needs are different. And for me to be doing all this work already as a campus supervisor and having the campus supervisor at Morro Bay not do the same kind of threw me off guard. That's why I asked for a campus supervisor one and a campus supervisor two to be reviewed. I think that's fair. I respect their decision. But I felt like if I didn't come up and speak my mind tonight, I'd go home and regret it. No disrespect to anybody, but I just felt like I had to come on and say that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Batch.
Thank you.
Mr. Spadafor.
Thank you, Marilyn. I had a question for Mr. Robinette, and thank you, Marvin, for that, to determine the content of Mr. Pesh's letter and also the issues related to the two campuses. And there would be one other factor that I would appreciate personally that be considered, and that's the bilingual capabilities of a person in that position. I think that that's an important factor for anyone in our school district who is responsible in the classroom or on the grounds for both parents and students who might be monolingual, more the parents. And we've had occasions where there have been monolingual parents who have not been able to have information translated to them that was very critical to the students' well-being at the schools. So my sense would be is have the Personnel Commission consider all of the issues that the staff brought forward, plus the contents of Mr. Pesch's letter, and also do consideration that there may be value for bilingualism in that position and even an encouragement that that take place. So that would be my sense as a better way to approach this than from this perspective. Thanks, Rick.
John, are you suggesting that we not approve this item tonight or that we approve this item as it is, which would signal to the Personnel Commission that the money's there and then have them review the classification afterwards?
I'd rather that this not be approved tonight, that it go back to the Personnel Commission and that all these other aspects be considered and then it be brought back to us regarding what the Personnel Commission feels is the best approach to the classification and to the salary scale, and also to the consideration of the bilingualism, which I think is an important factor in this position.
I guess further, my question further is, if we don't approve this tonight, will it have a negative effect on the classification range now? Our failure to approve it tonight won't impact the salary of the campus supervisors right away? Because yeah, I wouldn't want to disapprove something if it...
Range change is approved by both the board and the Personnel Commission, it takes effect literally the day after the last body act. So it would be... if Mr. Spadafore's desire was the board's desire, then it would be that we would have the Personnel Commission make the decision as far as range, come with the recommendation of that to the board, and then the day after the board met would be when the salary would go into effect. There's nothing retroactive. It's after the last body takes action. And if I can just address the bilingual aspect, it has always been a preferred aspect of the job description. We're very hesitant to make that a requirement of any position. For example, we would have an incumbent in our other position who does not have that requirement, and that would become a difficulty. We'd have to execute some sort of layoff if they couldn't meet the qualification and already had the position, or some sort of a grandfathering in. But it is part of the job description that bilingual candidates are preferred.
I am not recommending that that become a requirement, so someone is obviously removed from a position. I'm only saying that in the evaluation of positions, there can be levels, and bilingualism can be taken into consideration regarding different levels relative to any position or classification.
That is correct.
Mr. Millar.
Just so I understand, is this a process that the board and administration can use to either task or request that the Personnel Commission take up this particular issue? Because as I understand it, this has not been to the Personnel Commission yet.
It has not.
Okay. So is this a vehicle where we can say, hey, Personnel Commission, would you mind taking a look at this?
Sure. I'm happy to. I mean, it's really there. It's like I said, it's an interesting dance. The Personnel Commission has total authority, sole authority, to decide the job description, classification, and job titles and make recommendations of where that would fall. It's kind of a tricky thing between the unions, the board, and the Personnel Commission when it comes to the salary for that. But, for example, I'm happy to share Mr. Spadafore's concern about or desire to have bilingualism be a major consideration for the job. And that's something that I can certainly bring back to the commission, but it'll be their decision.
But if we don't go forward with this tonight, and I don't know the answer, that's why I'm asking, is the Personnel Commission free to say, okay, we're not really interested in doing a wholesale review of the position or as extensive a review of the position
sure.
as John?
Sure. They've asked us to review this position. It's part of the cycle.
Okay.
And this is something that the Commission is expecting.
Okay.
So they're expecting to have our assessment of this position.
Yeah, I have to
And
tell
I have
you.
No problem with, like I said, the chicken egg thing. We have no problem with having the Commission make all their recommendations. And
yeah, we're not adversarial to one another.
No.
We're trying to... Okay. I just want to add to what Marvin said and the other campus supervisors. We all know them well from
the Personnel Commission until it comes back from the Personnel Commission.
Okay. We have a motion by Mr. Buckman, a second by... Right, and I wanted to make a comment as well. But, Mr. Angel, please. John seconded.
Is staff recommending that both positions be classified at range number 221?
Yes, we're recommending one classification for the position for both schools.
Is it true, though, that so San Luis High does a totally different job or has a little bit more duties, so to speak, than Morro Bay High at this time?
You know, I think that anytime we have positions, duties kind of change in at school sites, and we believe the job specification, the job requirements, and the requirements of the job are similar at both of the schools. I think we have a situation where maybe at San Luis Obispo High School, the individual is going above and beyond some of the duties that are in the job description, but we think that they are consistent. And usually when there's things like volume, consider like the size of the school or the number of suspensions or the number of students. We address that through full-time equivalents, not through different types of job descriptions. It's highly unusual to create levels of job descriptions unless there are truly levels of responsibility that are different at the sites, and that would not be staff's recommendation.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Robinette. Nevertheless, it's my opinion... I know the board holds Mr. Petch in high regard. We've had a number of opportunities to deal with him, and he's very professional and a real service to the district. So it would be my feeling that I would support John's motion to have it go back to the Personnel Commission and then return to us in order to give Mr. Petch an opportunity to make his case at the Personnel Commission, and whatever their finding is will be their finding, but I would like to see him given the opportunity to make the case there I'm sorry, Mr. Reiner. So that said, and if we've all spoken, then, Mr. Spadafore, may I hear your motion again?
Actually, it's Mark's motion to table this. Okay. From the table. I think
Rick has a good understanding of the direction the board is discussing tonight while we table this motion.
I think so.
To go back and review this with the input and the consideration. And Mark's motion is to table it to allow the Personnel Commission to weigh in.
My motion is to table this motion to a time specific that when and if the Personnel Commission makes their finding.
Okay. And so, motion by Mr. Buckman, second by Mr. Spadafore. Those in favor? Aye. Opposed? It passes unanimously. Okay, now, Mr. Robinette. We have a similar item here regarding
may
the
make this other
custodian
one
three.
Too. Make this easy. We may need to just have that be the new protocol for these kinds of items, even though they are unusual, because usually reclassifications just come with job description changes and not changes with salary. This second one may be treated the same way, and that is absolutely fine. This is also a recommendation that will go to the Personnel Commission. That has to do with a reclassification of one of our custodian positions. We just completed a review of all the custodial job families, and very insignificant changes in job descriptions occurred for those ones, so nothing of much significance. But in the review, it became very apparent that the role of one particular position, which is the custodian three full-time position at the adult school district office complex, that the the changes that have occurred at that facility over the last 5 years have been extremely significant, and that we actually have programs from and staff from 7:30 in the morning sometimes till 11 at night, and that it is becoming more and more similar to what a school site experiences in terms of the need for a custodian. And so the custodian 3 position was created specifically to have a night custodian who has sole responsibility for a facility, for cleaning a facility. It's become apparent to us that the custodian 3 position, if that complex, the custodian 1. And again, that is in front of the personnel commission, or needs to be in front of the personnel commission also. So be happy to wait until that point, too, if that is what the board desired.
Mr. Spadafore.
I would like to make a motion that the board approve the recommendation of staff regarding Mr. Robinette's presentation.
Okay, moved by Mr. Spadafore, seconded by Mr. Millar. Those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Oh, we just moved approval of the recommendation so that if the Personnel Commission approves it, we're assuring the funding is there. You're in favor? Okay, and Mr. Buckman, you were opposed? Fine, so we are 6-1 in favor. Okay, thank you, Mr. Robinette. Item 8, approval of additional staff to meet special education preschool needs. Jackie Kirk-Martinez.
Good evening. This last year, we have transferred the students from the operation under the County Office of Education to our district. And this is a new process for us to come to you to ask for additional personnel support in the moderate to severe preschool program. Currently, we have 20 students, 3 to 5 years old, in that class, and one early childhood education, special education teacher. We have a SELPA guideline that we follow that all of the special ed directors have agreed to use as a guideline. Within that guideline, it's broken down into different columns of how many students and what we do with the staffing ratio. There is nothing in law that says how many numbers equal an FTE, like a kindergarten class size reduction of a 20-to-1 ratio. So in our SELPA guidelines, it does discuss that 10 to 12 students, we would start looking at a discussion of adding an additional class. Our class size is at 20 right now, and that again is moderate to severe students, all with IEPs. So those are very individualized programs. Tonight we're asking for an additional 0.6 FTE. There's an AM and a PM session running 3 hours each, and so this would allow an additional teacher to come in and support the full-time teacher, supporting an additional at least 8 more students that we are projecting between now and June.
Okay. Jackie, when you are trying to determine the staffing levels, is there, this is just more curiosity than anything else, is there a subjective determination? Do you and your staff and the teachers sort of look at the IEPs and the student needs that you're confronted with and then make whatever adjustments in addition to the SELPA guidelines?
The answer is yes. However, preschool is probably the most challenging age group to do projections because these students are coming in from unknown or never served before in the community. They come from the regional center. Sometimes we don't know about the students until they're almost 3 years old.
we can do the projections of the students that we know, but until we hold an assessment between 2.5 and 3 years old, and until we do that assessment, we really don't know if that child would best be served in a least restrictive and lesser restrictive environment in our PEEP program for mild moderate or in our self-contained moderate to severe program. But we do have an ongoing list that's updated every month. And we can do some projections. That's why I kind of gave you a projection of we know of at least 8 students that are potentially slated for this class between now and June. But it does ebb and flow.
Mr. Buckman.
I want, first of all, thank Jackie for her time today in going over this agenda item with me. And also Mrs. Matakovich for many hours yesterday. I want to just point out something or highlight something that Jackie said this evening. There's nothing in the law that says what the ratio needs to be. And in most of our other classroom situations, other than
positive impact on the County Office of Education program transfer, will this and the next item cut into that amount of money since these were students that would have been served there?
I think the answer is that had the program stayed under the authority of the County Office of Education, that there probably would have been a request for another staff member to be added and that we would have been billed for that additional staff member.
That would have been a percentage based across all the county, right? As opposed to the district paying the full freight for that particular personnel item. Is that correct?
Jackie, how did that work?
With the new funding model, it's based on the per pupil cost because of our new funding model.
What I guess I'm saying is that under the old system, costs for personnel were, and one of the problems was costs for personnel were shared among all the SELPA members because they were all regional programs. This cost will only be shared among San Luis Coastal and any other regional program that sends kids to it, right? Okay, thank you.
So significant changes in the new funding model allows us to be a little more reactive because as the kids show up, they're also earning ADA. So there's a revenue source now on these preschool kids as they come in, and it's a mitigation of the cost. But essentially, once you, like you said, this teacher is a superwoman in terms of being able to handle 20 kids. So there becomes a tip over point where the stress on the teacher becomes problematic.
And if I could just add one more thing, we also serve kids from other school districts, and there is a fee that's associated with those services that we provide, which I think will offset a significant portion of the cost that we're asking for.
Excuse me. That was exactly what I was going to say next, is currently we have 4 students from outside of our district in this preschool program, which we do have contracts with.
So, Jackie, at the beginning of your presentation, am I remembering that correctly that you said there was sort of an agreement within the SELPA that the cap would be 12 or 13 students?
It's a guideline that we would look at, start the discussion of needing a new class between 10 and 12 students in total for that classroom, preschool SDC. And we look at prioritizing lists, accessing the ability to move students either to the North County or South County if they have preschool day classes that have a lower ratio. All preschools are at a pretty high level of capacity right now. But, yes, we do have a SELPA guideline.
A guideline of 10 to 12.
Correct, for the preschool SDC.
We're currently at 20.
Yes.
And looking at going to 28.
By the end of the year.
So I guess my question would be, why are we only asking for a 0.6?
Mr. Unger said, we have a Wonder Woman teaching. I'll aside is that we're looking at the quality of the program, and Ms. Brisky is able to provide a high-quality program while utilizing her paraeducators as well and working on specific goals, individualized programs. So it really it depends on all of those structures, structured environment, a talented teacher, well-trained paraeducators, and that's why we feel we can utilize only a 0.6 FTE and that we don't need an additional full-time person at this time.
Okay. Well, it's just so long as we're sure that the children will be adequately served with a 0.6 and a 15-hour a week paraeducator, because it sounds like we're going more than double what the SELPA guidelines are.
Correct. And this is, again, a guideline. And we like to be conservative and look at what we utilize for teachers, certificated staff, what they need. But then also we do have support staff. We have speech and language therapists who come in and support the students, as well as occupational therapists, adaptive PE specialists. So we do have other staff members who help support the class as a whole.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Spadafor.
Yeah, thank you, Marilyn. If the use settlement happens, does the ADA with this program that you're referring to regarding the staffing increase have a factor in that or not?
No, it does not. The settlement agreement goes into the general fund.
I know that, but the use settlement's based on ADA. From what I understand with a brief presentation.
Stating earlier that preschool doesn't have this legal limit, speech and language pathologists do have an average total FTE. Let me back up. The 55 students are what each district and SELPA are supposed to have on their caseload for speech and language services. Right now, we're over that limit in our district for their FTE. Speaking with the speech and language therapists every month, we have meetings, and they're talking about the intensity of the students, the rise in specific disabilities, and right now we're averaging about 65 students on their caseload. And so we are looking to add speech and language pathologists to provide high-quality, consistent quality program, especially for our early intervention K through fifth grade students. We're seeing a large number of identification. So we're asking for a 1.2 FTE speech and language pathologist addition.
Okay, I'll move approval of this item.
That puts us within Ed Code then?
It does.
Okay. I'll second that motion.
So I've made the motion and Mr. Angel has seconded it. Did you have a question,
yeah.
Stronger?
Is this another remnant of the program transfers?
It has a, I would say a remnant, but we're seeing a larger identification in the general population, not the moderate severe. So those numbers haven't changed relative to last year.
Are we looking at, as a speech pathologist, are we looking at why, given declining enrollment, we're seeing an increase in identified students for speech and language?
The speech and language pathologists are asking the same question. Because they're doing a lot of research on that. We're seeing a lot of language needs, the perspective taking. We are seeing a rise in the autism, and that has a direct effect to the speech and language pathologist's requirements to serve students and increase their social skills as well as communication skills. So that has a direct correlation.
Anyone else? Okay, then we have a motion on the table. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? That passes unanimously.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jackie. Item 9, No. Item 10. Where the heck am I? 10. Approval of 2008-2009 Consolidated Application for Funding Categorical Aid Programs, Part 2. Mrs. Delkiskamp.
Thank you. Good evening. Our district applies for categorical funds both from the state and from the federal government by completing a consolidated application. And in June of 2008, we presented part one of the 2008-2009 consolidated application. Tonight I'm presenting and seeking your approval for part two of the consolidated application so that we may submit it by January 31st, which is our deadline. Attached to this agenda item is a summary of each categorical program that's included in the consolidated application part two and the consolidated application itself. When you look at the application, it has mainly three types of reports in there. It has expenditure reports, it has allocation reports, and then there are reports that where we need to provide data for certain programs. So at this time, I invite the board's discussion or any questions you may have.
Mr. Buckman.
Again, I want to thank staff for walking me through this. The biggest question I had was as I was going down on page 10.13, which is the list of schools and the percent of low-income students. My concern was that the school with the second highest percentage was Pacific Beach, but no money was going to Pacific Beach. You want to tell me what I learned?
Yes. As far as Title I is concerned, our district in previous years made the decision, and we are allowed to do this, whether we want to concentrate our Title I monies within a certain grade span, and it was decided by our district several years back that we wanted to concentrate those efforts at the K-6 level, and I think because...
And it shows our 2008 numbers for those students higher than our 2009 numbers. Is that just because an estimate, because we know what the real 2008 numbers were and we're just guessing on the 2009s?
Well,
is that how that works?
Well, those, it says class of 2008 and 2009. So class of 2008 were our seniors last year.
And so they had more opportunities to take it? Is that where it's coming from?
Well, and class of 2009 shows our current seniors, so it just may be that we have fewer students in that class that need that intervention. So maybe fewer seniors who are English learners. And in the previous year, that class could have included more English learners.
Okay, and I know we've probably talked about this. Are we seeing our English learners pass the CASI at a greater rate than we were in the past due to interventions? Do we know that?
I can't answer that specifically, but something I could follow up with if you desire.
Mr. Buckman.
I'd like to make a motion to approve the second part of the CONAP.
Okay, moved by Mr. Buckman, seconded by Mr. Spadafore. Those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Passes unanimously.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mrs. Delkiskamp. Item 11 is approval to pay board member salary for permissible absence or alternate meeting. I'll move approval of item 11.
Second.
Okay.
Madam President?
Yes.
I have 33 questions on this item.
Would you like to begin now, Mr. Buckman?
Do you want to do that after we show the photographs of where he really was? But okay.
Those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So we have 6 in favor with 1 abstention. Moving on to the action consent, please let me know if you would like any of these pulled. Item 12, approval of certificated and classified personnel items. Item 13, approval of instructional calendar for 2009-2010. Pull that. Approval of reopener agreement with Service Employees International Union. Acceptance of donations. Disposition of surplus property. Approval of furniture and equipment requests. Approval of purchase orders. Approval of warrants and payroll. Approval of quarterly report on uniform complaint filings, the Williams settlement.
I'd like to make a motion, Madam Chair, that we approve 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, and 20, please.
Okay, and I'll second. Those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That passes unanimously. Item 12, Mr. Unger.
Yeah, I just wanted to acknowledge Thordis Sager, who was one of our special education paraeducators at C.L. Smith, and she passed away a couple of weeks ago. I had the honor to work with Thordis in my job at the County Office of Education several years ago. She was a caring, hard-working, loving instructional assistant. She also was heavily involved in the Morro Bay Yacht Club. She had a great sense of humor. She authored a couple of cookbooks. She produced several children, one of whom is an educator up in Paso Robles. And so I just wanted to acknowledge Thordis and her memory. Given that, I'd like to move approval of item number 12.
Second. Moved by Mr. Unger, seconded by Mr. Millar. Those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? That passes unanimously. Okay, item 13. Mr. Buckman, you pulled that.
Thank you very much. I have just several questions on this change to the calendar. And I guess, first of all, I'm wondering, I remember back when we did year-round education and we were making the transition, and we often heard that when there was 2 weeks off, the children forgot everything they learned and had to come back to school and sort of be brought back up to speed. I'm also concerned whether we've created a problem for parents with childcare, having an extra week where they have to take care of the children from morning till night.
We wrote contract language to kind of push the timeline up a little bit 2 years ago, that by November 1st we will get a committee made up of administration and teachers to look at calendars. We then get calendars that are acceptable from an administrative level, but also acceptable for the Teachers Association. They conduct their own internal vote, and we bring it to the board then for their approval. Both the board and the Teachers Association have equal say over it. The parent consideration hasn't been one that we have done. The three factors that usually go into it is one, are we developing a calendar that is somewhat consistent with what happens in our county? It's always been Dr. Crocker's wish that the whole county was on the same calendar. It's an impossible wish. I mean, it would be a wonderful thing to have, believe me, but the fact that we have contracts that are different lengths, we're one of the few districts that only have a 183-day teacher contract, and that creates problems. And CMR seems very tied to their three-week Christmas break. Paso Robles has been having a two-week spring break for some time. And there's just things that make that difficult. But we try to keep within certain parameters of generally starting and stopping at the same time. We also have to look at legal holidays, of course, and we have to look at contractual holidays or contractual days off with our classified bargaining units, because there are certain days that they have to have off, and we don't want to have school when they have to have the day off. And then the other thing is to make sure we plug in our trimester, semester dates, our final exams, our parent conference weeks at times that make sense. But really it's been the process to have the Teachers Association take ownership of coming up with a proposal that meets those parameters and then bringing it to the board for your consideration. So the parent component has been one that I guess would happen here, but it hasn't been something that we have surveyed or sought before. And I don't think the Teachers Association has done that either.
Mr. Angel.
What impact will having 2 weeks off in April have on state testing?
Dr. Matakovich, I don't think any. We have about a 130-day window for testing, and I don't think there'll be an impact on that.
Mr. Angel, are you done? Okay. Mr. Spadafore?
I wanted to... Oh, excuse me. It's Mr. Buckman's poll.
It's just that you don't want to deal with number 13, John. I'd like to make a motion to approve item 13.
Moved by Mr. Buckman. Second.
I think you might have public comment on this one.
Please. Mr. Furby.
Dave Furby from Morro Bay High. I did have some concerns when I saw the schedule come out. I mean, I am concerned as a math teacher, and I'm concerned about the state test scores. And I think taking a 16-day break just prior to doing state testing is maybe not a great idea. I don't have any evidence that it won't be, but it just doesn't feel right. I know we just came back from Christmas break, and they always come back kind of groggy, and you know, it takes us a week to get back to speed. And the way it looks like on the calendar now, they'll come back, have 1 week, and then state testing starts right after that. There's some other things that this calendar change would affect. Currently, we have a 10-week summer, and we run a 7-week summer school in the middle of that. It usually goes a week off, 7 weeks of summer school, and then a 2-week break. And I've done it many, many years. I've taught summer school over and over again. And that's been enough of a break for me, and I think it's enough of a break for the kids. With a new calendar, we'd have a 9-week summer and still have to run a 7-week summer school. So you'd only get a week ahead, a week after. I think it can have an effect on the kids as far as just not having enough of a break to get their batteries recharged, come back to class. A couple other things would be, I don't know for sure that the vote, as it was done, really reflects a majority of the teachers were in favor of it. Because as far as we can tell from the statistics, 39% voted for the schedule that got approved. There were three schedules put forward. The other two schedules were identical in that they still had a 1 week spring break. The only thing that was different about them is the placement of the single day. One of them was in October on one schedule, and on the other, it was placed in April. So to me, if we were going to run voting theories that ought to be done mathematically, we would have taken the top two and had a runoff election between those, because of the fact that the two were so similar. So I have a question about that. So it's just issues. I don't know if any of these have been thought of by the committee that came up with the schedule or not. And the people that I've talked to, I just haven't heard any argument in favor of it, how it's going to be educationally better for us. The people that I have talked to that voted in favor of it were thinking of themselves and about the break that they wanted to have in April, and that it gave them more time to take a trip. And I just don't know if that's the best educational plan that we should have.
It's before us of how this decision was made and what the pros and cons were and what the impact on learning and teaching would be. So I guess at this point, I'm the question I had was, are we bound to approve this? And the answer is no. Okay, thank you.
Okay, Mr. Buckman.
I'd like to withdraw my motion, please.
I had one question about the process. What's a little bit unsettling about this is that, from what Mr. Furby said, there were three proposals. Two of them dealt with a 1 week break, just a few days difference, and the third one was with 2 weeks. My question is, what happened to the process to get it to this point so that wouldn't have been addressed, or was it ever addressed by the teachers, who in the past we have just approved the calendar when it's been presented to us because it was voted on and that was how it was? This is the first time I can remember that this question has been raised as to the process. So my question is there something different about the process this year, Rick, that wasn't present in the past? And are we dealing with something that's kind of under the surface that is creating issues?
Yeah, I probably defer to the SLCTA, and because I don't get involved in their internal voting mechanism and how they go forward. What is a little different is that we have usually kind of settled on two calendars to bring for vote. One that's a status quo, kind of kind of regular run-of-the-mill, like we always have had, calendar. And usually, because I know SLCTA does membership surveys on what they're interested in, what the teachers are interested in, and usually a second calendar that usually has either a three-week winter break or a two-week spring break, frankly. That's how it's been the last 5 years. And then they vote and always vote the one-week one in, and that's what we do. This time, the committee decided, let's put out the three calendars because there was enough change there. And as I looked at the votes, there was not a clear majority. There was one that received the most votes, but it wasn't a majority. And the associate, you know, offered the association the ability to look at that, or because I knew there was some controversy there. But that's the association's business. So we have, I have not got involved in their voting procedures and wouldn't want to get involved in that.
Just as a follow-up question, if it's okay, is because it usually is a pro forma matter that the vote is taken and it's presented and then the board says, fine, that's what the teachers have voted upon, which I respect greatly. I had a couple of phone calls which said, we support the vote of the teachers. Don't let any one or two or three individuals come in and change the vote of the teachers, because that's what it was. And I respect Mr. Furby greatly. I respect his input. So what bothers me here tonight, maybe there's no answer to it, is why there is this undercurrent of question about the process, only the process. And I'm always a respectful person about due process. I think you question that. But the due process here is the vote comes, the teachers approve it, and the board says if that's what the teachers vote for, so be it. I'm a little bit concerned about how the process came, and maybe nobody can answer that, and maybe Walt has.
Well, I don't, go, Walter?
I was just going to say that, first of all, it's not the first time we've dealt with a controversy related to how the Teachers Association arrived at a vote on a particular schedule. I believe it was Laguna's schedule, and there was some controversy about that. It's not our role to cure defects in the CTA's balloting process or election process. If anyone in our administration can tell us if there's an interest that the board should have in not approving this schedule, then I think we should be talking about that. CTA can deal with their own membership and how they came to some consensus on which schedule they wanted to bring forward in the negotiations between the board and the district and the Teachers Association. So I'd kind of like to get on with approving this.
Mr. Angel.
I, too, respect the association's position in being able to negotiate a contract. What concerns me is when you make I don't want to use the word significant change, but it is a large change in the schedule without having a lot of parent input. That would just concern me as a parent myself.
Okay, well, oh, Mr. Bedrugian, I'm sorry.
Bruce Bedrugian, SLCTA president. I'd just like to illuminate some history for the school board and as far as this vote goes. The committee, it consisted of three teachers, elementary teacher, middle school, high school teacher, and Mr. Robinette. And that's how we've done it in the past. And usually we do come up with two schedules. But right now, this is what the teachers voted, and that's how it played out. There wasn't any malfeasance or anything on the committee. The committee did their job. They were just trying to give teachers more choices. And so this is how the vote turned out. But I want you to know that it is up to you, and we'll respect your decision. But we felt that the process worked. The teachers were informed. They read. They knew what was going on, and they voted. And that's how it played out. So, just wanted to let you know that. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else?
One last thing. I just thought of one other thing. As far as history goes, I remember one of the former presidents said it was San Luis Coastal, actually, that was the first school in this county to go ahead and put the spring break after Easter. We're the first ones to do that. And then soon other schools and the county followed suit. It is a change. Is it going to negatively impact teachers or students? Well, you know, that's something for you to think about. But I would like to say that you know, all the teachers have the opportunity to go ahead and vote and weigh in on this. We presented it to our executive board. Like Mr. Spadafore said, we had some. Well, it's only five people that contacted our office, but we did put it by the executive board, and I said, "What do you want to do?" And they did. They still said, "We want to stand by our vote." So, thank you.
Mr. Furby.
There's just one more point I forgot to make, and that's that with this schedule, the two semesters are imbalanced also by 8 days, I'm pretty sure. So the first semester is shorter than, the first semester is longer than the second, which is not huge for year-long courses. It wouldn't be that big a deal, but for the semester courses, the second semester course is going to be shorter. And so that's, I just don't know that that's anything that's been discussed with the principal or even discussed at all. So, thanks.
Thank you.
I'm going to make a motion to postpone this item to our first meeting in February. I would like to see what the if there's any discussion in the change of bylaws from the CTA site reps. And then I'd like to – well, that's my motion.
I'll second that.
A motion by Mr. Unger, second by Dr. Eisengrath Rogers. Those in favor? Mr. Millar.
Discussion.
Well, so what you're saying is we're going to wait for them to come back and see if they've changed the rules that they want to operate on, and then we're going to renegotiate this calendar based on that?
Or I could very well make a motion not to accept this, or we have a motion to accept it, and then we can take a vote and we can see where it goes. Let's vote on my motion, and then we'll see where it goes.
You know, before we do the vote, I have another comment to make. I'm sorting through in my own mind the process that this is taking, and what bothers me is this. There's been a practice and a custom to have the Teachers Association do this, and we're now saying we want to have someone reconsider what has been done in the past. And at a certain point, I have to assume that the teachers have thought about the issues related to the students and the schools and the impact that this would have on the teaching year. And tonight I'm going to vote against Chris's motion only because I'm assuming that the teachers have taken that into consideration. And I would hope, and I can't imagine that they would not have now and in the future, thought about these issues before it's presented to us. And I'm very uncomfortable to change a custom and a practice of the past to allow the same body to review what they've already done. It doesn't quite fit well. So that's my position.
May I withdraw my motion then? I'm going to withdraw, if with the permission of the board, I'll withdraw that motion to postpone this, and I'm going to make a motion not to accept this instructional calendar.
Okay, so that's moved by Mr. Unger, seconded by Dr. Eisendrath Rogers. Those in favor? Is there discussion? Okay, discussion.
I don't see the impact, and I'm wondering why the board is hesitant at that. There hasn't been an outcry, so I respect Mr. Spadafore's suggestion, and I don't see why we make a change in this. But thank you.
Mr. Millar.
I agree with John. You know, the president of the negotiating body that has the 50% responsibility has come up here twice and told us that from his organization's standpoint, the vote was appropriate, their selection was appropriate, was vetted by their teachers, and whether or not it was a perfect vote or not, it was vetted by the executive committee. And he's reiterated twice in front of us that this is the calendar that they're proposing. I think it is really ill-advised that we're now going to wring our hands and change the ground rules and tell our equal negotiating partner that, hey, you need to go back and rethink what you're asking for because we don't agree with how you came up with it. I think if we want to discuss with CTA in the future or have staff and CTA work together to come up with a more inclusive, heaven forbid, process of picking the school calendar, that's fine. I don't think tonight, by the way, on the second meeting discussion of this item, I mean, I don't remember this long a discussion on when it came up the first time, even though some of the items that came up tonight were addressed at the previous meeting. So I oppose that motion as well, and I think we ought to approve the calendar.
Okay, well, and my feeling is that the calendar is approved jointly by SLCTA and the district, and I think the vote was very close to those three areas, but I don't take issue with that. But I think Mr. Furby's points are well taken. And I don't know that this calendar is in the best interest of students. So until I'm satisfied that it is, I'm not inclined to approve this calendar. Dr. Eisendrath Rogers.
I'd just like to say that I was influenced by Mr. Bedrigian's comment that the site reps have some ambivalence about the process they went through to get to this decision. And the reason I seconded your first motion, Chris, is that was exactly my question, was if we could just wait to hear whether they themselves, since we do respect the union and what their collective group decides, to see if there is a desire on their part to change the process that they followed and therefore possibly come back with a different vote.
See, that's why I actually changed it when I thought about it, because that seemed to me to be meddling in union affairs. As I thought it through, it felt to me the cleanest thing to say was that I was not satisfied with this and to send it back for renegotiation from the district's perspective and then see what happens.
I guess I'm a bit conflicted as well. I see the need for maintaining our relationship and working with our past practice. However, my other concern is I totally trust teachers. They make professional judgments. And what I saw is a majority of the professional teachers voted to have 1 week off rather than the 2 week off, 2 weeks off.
Mr. Buckman.
Yeah. Again, conflicted, I think, is a good word. But for me, we are the other 50% of this decision. It's not administration. It's the association and us. And I'm uncomfortable with a change that could affect both the teachers and the parents and the rest of the district.
So now we still, Mr. Mueller.
I'm sure the association is going to appreciate our help in managing their affairs.
Again, I think clearly what this is the teacher's input is valued and desired, but it's the board that ultimately has to make the decision, and we do this jointly. And I'd like to see us continue to do this jointly, and I'd like to see if there's possibly another calendar that comes forward or if there can be more discussion, but it's not just one or the other. It's both of us that have to make this decision.
Are we ready to take a vote on this? We have a motion on the table by Mr. Unger, seconded by Dr. Eisendrath Rogers. Those in favor. Okay, Chris, can you restate your motion?
SLCTA do something different. I need to have some direction on what the board wants me to do as your emissary in this matter.
I have no interest in dictating to SLCTA their internal, the way they manage their affairs internally. I don't think that's appropriate for the board to get involved in. And I don't believe that's true, Walter. But my interest is to I don't believe that a 2-week spring break is in the best interest of students of this district, and so that's my belief. I would like you to go back as my emissary, and I don't know how the other board members feel, to propose a different calendar that the teachers can vote on.
You have your marching orders.
Well, the only I have just one thing I wanted to add.
Mr. Spadafore.
You know, I think the fine-tuning that may go on still has to reflect the fact that it's a decision by the teachers in terms of their vote. Now, if the teachers internally believe that having two proposals that represent 1 week with a day or two different and having one vote represent 2 weeks is the way it should be presented, and if they present it again and the vote comes back the same way, then nothing has changed. But if the teachers believe that you present one calendar that has a 1 week break and a 2 week break, and so you have a philosophical discussion about what 1 week does or what 2 weeks does, then you have another type of vote in that regard. But I think it's the teachers that have to decide that. I think that whether we believe one is better than the other for students, there's no empirical data tonight that's been presented one way or the other. So I believe of us saying, here's what is better, go back and figure out a way to do it, is not our role. I think that the teachers have to decide what's the best way to present this to the teachers. And then we can come back and have a clear vote and hopefully be comfortable with that.
Mr. Millar.
Well, it sounds to me like there is at least some interest on the board to instruct our negotiator not that this is what we don't want in the calendar. And if one of the things we don't want is a 2-week spring break, then we ought to have the guts to tell our negotiator that that's something we don't want you to negotiate for. I mean, you know, it's one thing to shoot this down, but where does Rick go from here?
I, for one, feel like I don't know enough about the subject to have an opinion on whether it's in the best interest of children or not, but I do agree with John's point, which is I remain uncertain whether this calendar reflects the interest of the plurality of the teachers.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Robinette, are you clear on what's being asked of you? We'll work it out. Okay. Okay. So then, Mr. Buckman, this was the item that you pulled. Would you like to?
We're done.
We're done with it? Okay. Oh, God. Okay. Okay. Advance agenda. Mr. Millar.
I would like to propose a staff presentation at the board meeting on board policy, the formulation of it, the role it plays vis-a-vis administrative regulations and the conduct of business of the district. I'd also like a small portion of that to brief the board on the revision that we did, the review. When was that? Patty was working on it, too. Yeah, where we went, the big one, yeah. And how, the main thing I'm trying to get at is the nuts and bolts of how we formulate policy and the role that CSBA plays in it and how policy at the board level interacts with administrative regulations and the way business is done in the district. Anybody want to support that?
I'll support that as well, in hoping that Walt would also allow us. There's numerous board policies that require them to come back to the board annually, and I'd like to sort of see a list of those board policies.
Okay, so in keeping with our the policy that we've established on how an agenda item is set. We will come back at the next board meeting, and you and Mark, I guess, will present a justification for this to the board.
Well, that's a process that we...
Aye. Opposed? So that passes unanimously. Okay. Mr. Spadafore has moved adjournment, and I'll second that. We are adjourned.